This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Gazelle Natural Fiber Clothing, featuring 100% natural fiber clothing for women and men. Real clothing for real people. Proud to sponsor the important voice of KABU, Gazelle is located at Northeast 41st and Fremont and can be reached at 503-288-3422.
With our allies in the fight for affordable health care.
I'm Andy Seaton, KABU News.
For KBOO in Portland, I'm Julie Sabatier.
KABU's Afifa Ahmed Shafi reports.
I'm Stephanie Potter, KABU News.
KABU's Eduardo Delanderos Tiere has more.
I'm Annalisa Hummel.
And I'm Liam Delta.
This is Maddie Bowden.
I'm Alex Collins, KABU News.
I'm Michael Newman, KABU News.
I'm Courtney Dillard, KABU News.
Coming up on the KABU Evening News, anti-war protests have occurred at occupied. Anti-war protesters have occupied Senator Ron Wyden's office. The Washington State Supreme Court is expected to release a decision any day on the fate of gay marriage, and big corporations are misleading consumers, telling them that bottled water is better for you than tap water.
And in the human cost of occupation in Iraq, as of today, there have been 2,318 officially acknowledged deaths of American soldiers, with as many as 48,000 others wounded. IraqBodyCount.org reports over 37,000 civilians have been reported killed by military interventions in Iraq. Last year, the medical journal The Lancet reported as many as 194,000 civilian casualties, not counting Fallujah, since the invasion. Good evening. This is the KABU Evening News for Monday, March 20th, 2006. I'm Marlise Franklin.
And I'm Andy Seaton. Sunday's peace rally in downtown Portland brought out thousands of peaceful protesters. The march filled 25 city blocks as protesters chanted, drummed, protested the war in Iraq, and celebrated the cause of peace. The Associated Press reports Portland's demonstrations are among the largest in the world. KABU's Rabia Yemen collected sights and sounds of the Sunday demonstration.
Sunday's peace march brought thousands of protesters out into the streets of Portland. What follows are the sounds of protest and the celebration of peace and love.
I said the system doesn't work no more.
What did you say?
I said the system pushes down the poor.
What did you say?
I said stop.
Sadness that the change in the world is happening needs to go in a different direction. We need to start bringing the world together as one.
I think it's a good way to show that war is not the answer for everything.
We believe in peace and we want to spread it around the world.
Well, to fight for peace and not for hate.
I would like to get rid of George Bush for one thing, because he's doing everything wrong. And all the deaths and everything, that's his fault. And the deaths and the blood is on his shoulders.
David joined the National Guard right after 9/11, hoping to help people in Oregon and this community. He never once anticipated going to Iraq. None of us did, obviously. He was a cook in the National Guard. That's what he did here in Portland. And he had a lot of friends in his National Guard unit that were in his motorcycle club, so he got to work with them and feed them. And he was really proud of his cooking because he was a good cook. His unit won several awards after he got in there. But when they activated David's unit, they didn't need cooks because Halliburton's providing meals. So they didn't have a position for David. So they transferred him to a unit in Cottage Grove that was activated before his unit. So he went over before his original unit. They cross-trained him into a machine gunner since they didn't need cooks. So he was a machine gunner on an unarmored Humvee. He was 6 months over there, 2 weeks from getting married, maybe, in Italy. He was the 14th vehicle in a 14-vehicle resupply convoy going north out of Baghdad. A roadside improvised explosive device was set off. They generally pick on the last vehicle, so it gives time for the bombers to get out away. And they formed their little defensive circle, The Humvee was thrown in the air, turned totally around, and when the dust settled and they all got out, they were all patting themselves on the backs, overjoyed because none of them got hurt. And they looked up and David was slumped over his machine guns. And you could, from the pictures, we could see where the shrapnel went through the side of the unarmored Humvee, and it hit David in the back of the head. And we hope he died instantly. We, you know, yeah, so.
That report was filed by KBOO's Rabia Yemen.
92 Oregon National Guard soldiers returned to home base in Pendleton Sunday after a one-year tour of duty in Afghanistan. Roughly 2,000 people filled the Pendleton Convention Center to welcome home members of the D Company, 113th Aviation Battalion. Governor Ted Kulongoski was joined at the demobilization ceremony by Senators Gordon Smith and Ron Wyden, Representative Greg Walden, and Major General Fred Reese, the Adjutant General of the Oregon National Guard. Walden presented a flag he had flown over the United States Capitol in the unit's honor and acknowledged the families of Staff Sergeant Tane Baum and Warrant Officer Adrian Stump, members of the unit who were killed last September when their CH-47 Chinook helicopter crashed in Afghanistan after being struck by enemy fire. The families of the fallen were presented with a flag, and Kulongoski spoke of the sacrifice made by all the soldiers and their families. Both were Pendleton natives.
There was an accident yesterday at the Umatilla Chemical Agent Disposal Facility. A fire occurred during the processing of an M-55 chemical rocket in one of the explosive containment rooms. Depot officials reported the fire occurred at about 2 a.m. in the morning yesterday, but it was quickly extinguished and no one was reported injured. Rocket processing resumed at both rooms shortly after noon yesterday. Officials say the fire and chemical agent were contained within the room. They also claim that there no immediate harm came to any workers.
Local activists took the weekend's peace events into offices of Oregon Senator Ron Wyden today. KBOO reporter Kate Welch has the story.
A group of 19 entered Senator Wyden's office this morning. Judith Beck read their statement.
Among us are journalists, a retired medical social worker, a Catholic priest, college professors, nurses, an office manager, students, retirees, and others. Our common uniting force is that we are heartsick, appalled, dismayed, and disgusted by the actions of our government in its preemptive attack on and occupation of Iraq.
While the delegation delivered petitions to Senator Wyden's office, community leaders held a press conference explaining why Portland residents can no longer wait for an end to the war with Iraq. The noontime demonstration convened at Terry Schrunk Plaza, where religious leaders joined representatives of Vets for Peace, September 11th Families for Peace, and other community leaders, urging Senator Wyden to take action. Their calls to end the war and begin the peace echoed the thousands who took to the streets yesterday, marking the third anniversary of the United States invasion of Iraq.
The first speaker is Reverend Wes Taylor.
Today in this nation, there are more hungry than 3 years ago. Today, there are more homeless than 3 years ago. Today, there are more people living in poverty than 3 years ago. Today, there are more families in need of health insurance than 3 years ago. Let us stomach war no more. Thank you.
I'm Reverend Gabrielle Chavez. This unjust, immoral, unjustified war is now unpopular. It took a little courage for Senator Wyden 3 years ago to be one of those senators to vote against the war. We're not asking you to do anything very hard right now. It's time for our representatives to represent us. to end the war, begin the peace. Thank you.
I'm Rabbi Aryeh Hirschfield. 3 years ago, we knew very clearly that this war was going to be a disaster. And now we've watched unfold exactly what we expected to have unfold. So I'm here today to express my outrage once again at this immoral war that our government has brought us into. Let's make our representatives hear us, let them be heard, and let's stop this madness of this horrific war. Thank you.
My name is Iman Ahmed Khamas. I came here from Baghdad. Of course, there are no benefits, neither to the American people nor to the Iraqi people. The occupation is wrong. Stop this occupation and stop these atrocities and crimes.
Good morning. My name is Valerie Chapman. One of the main reasons that I'm here today is in support of the people who have gone into Senator Wyden's office. They stand in a long line of a history of prophetic people, holy men and women who are willing to take the risk of standing up.
I'm Kate Welch, KABU News.
And now an update from the Senator Wyden story. A spokesperson for the protesters called about an hour ago from Wyden's office and had this to say.
As I speak, there are police, Portland police cars and Federal Protective Homeland Security vehicles, and we understand that the group inside has committed an act of civil disobedience and are now discussing their arrest options. They decided that they wanted to stay in Senator Ron Wyden's office until he was willing to negotiate with them, and his staff has refused to speak with them.
That was a spokesperson who asked to be only identified as Joy at today's protest at Senator Wyden's office.
Stay tuned for independent native news following our newscast, then at 6 p.m. here, Labor Radio. At 7, it's Time Sound with Kevin Berry. Tonight's weather, mostly cloudy with a slight chance of showers and lows around 35 degrees. Hood River can expect mostly cloudy skies with a chance of rain showers and a low of 35. Corvallis will be mostly cloudy with a chance of rain showers and a low of 38. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy with a chance of showers and highs around 50 degrees. Hood River, in a Hood River, mostly cloudy skies with scattered rain showers and a high of 53 degrees. In Corvallis, will be mostly cloudy with a chance of showers and a high of 50 degrees. You're listening to the KABU Evening News in Portland, Corvallis, Vancouver, and Hood River.
State officials are asking some homeowners to start keeping a diary of their pesticide use. Participants will be asked to record the date, location, reason, amount, and name, and registration number of the pesticide. The goal is for 250 households across Oregon to participate each quarter. Officials from Pesticide Division of the Oregon Department of Agriculture say they want to know exactly which products are being used and in what quantities. State officials said they think this is the first state-funded household pesticide survey in the country. The survey is part of a pesticide use reporting program that was introduced originally in 1999, but lack of funds has stalled the survey for nearly 7 years, but was funded again starting this January. Officials hope the survey will educate the public about pesticide use and protecting streams from chemicals.
The Washington State Supreme Court is expected to release a decision any day on Washington's Defense of Marriage Act, passed by the legislature in 1998. The law says marriage must be between a man and a woman. Two Superior Court judges have found the law unconstitutional. Now, the state's highest court will decide whether Washington will become the second state to start issuing marriage license to same-sex couples. Massachusetts became the first in 2004. If the court sends the issue back to lawmakers to decide, State Representative Ed Murray says he'll introduce legislation next year that would allow same-sex marriage. If the court permits the law to stand, Murray said he would introduce legislation to offer same-sex couples the same rights that marriage guarantees other couples.
The current time is 5:17:09. And now for something completely different. Daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
You'll be excited to learn that your government is protecting you with a new surveillance program. It's the National Animal Identification System, authorized by the Patriot Act, but being implemented by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. This thing will compel every owner of even one cow, horse, pig, goat, sheep, llama, chicken, turkey, duck, goose, or any other form of livestock to be registered in a federal database and to have each and every one of their animals tracked 24/7 from birth to death. By every owner, I don't merely mean the commercial producers with big herds and flocks. NAIS's database will also include old granny who keeps one laying hen in the backyard, city dwellers with a pot-bellied pig, families who own a riding horse, someone with a pet goat or goose, everyone. And by tract, I mean every home, farm, horse stable, county fairground, pigeon coop, or other location that has as many as one of these animals on it will be compelled to register with the government and get a premise ID. It will include not only personal data on the owner, but also the GPS coordinates of the premises for constant satellite monitoring. The owner will pay an annual fee for the privilege of registering their premises. Then, owners will be required to have every single one of their animals implanted with RFID tags. Another fee will be assessed for this. There's also a time tax, for owners must report within 24 hours all animal events, births, deaths, or any trips off the premises. Go to the vet, a horse show, or take your kid's chicken to the county fair, and you must report or be subject to a stiff fine. This is Jim Hightower saying, I'm told that the people who created NAIS did exempt jackasses because they didn't want to put a chip in their own hides. To fight this insanity, go to StopAnimalID.org. Today's commentary is made possible in part by the good folks at Mother Jones Magazine. Over the years, Mother Jones has won just about every award available while ticking off the honchos of business and government. They're proud of both distinctions. Find out more at MotherJones.com.
Water quality is an issue throughout the world, even here in Portland, where our drinking water comes from one of the most pristine sources in the United States. Many families drink bottled water because of the fear of contamination from lead pipes in their homes. But bottled water, is that free of contamination? A new campaign in Portland is trying to force corporate water bottles, water bottlers to clean up their act on a variety of fronts. It's called the Think Outside the Bottle campaign. Tonight we have live with us in the studio Mary Nickel. She's the field organizer for Corporate Accountability International. Mary, thanks for coming in.
You're welcome.
There are several issues around corporate accountability and water. Would you give us a brief laundry list of the issues of the Think Outside the Bottle campaign?
Sure. Well, our Think Outside the Bottle campaign is really a direct challenge to the marketing muscle of the bottled water corporations, where corporations like Coke, Nestle, and Pepsi are really setting out to turn water into a profit-driven commodity like oil, and they're spending tons of money to steer the public and public policies in this direction, where, you know, half of all Americans drink bottled water, and one in six only drink bottled water, even though it is much more expensive than tap water and sometimes less safe.
Mm-hmm. So how about some of the, I've heard of a lot of scandals. Tell us about some of the scandals involved with bottled water and how it's bottled.
Sure. Well, most recently in 2004 in the UK, Coke, whose product is Dasani, had to take 500,000 bottles of their water product off the shelves because there was known traces of bromide, which is a known carcinogen. And also an NRDC report released recently took a sample of about 1,000 different bottled waters and found that 300 of them had known carcinogens in them.
So is it actually safer?
Well, that's what the corporations are trying to make you think. They're putting tens of millions of dollars into marketing their product, mm-hmm. And assuming that it's safer and it's cleaner, whereas one-fourth of bottled water is actually just tap water that they're bottling up from the municipal sources and hiking up about 10,000 times the cost.
Wow. So is it really, our water, is it really that scarce? And maybe you could tell us a little bit about the big picture of water and its politics.
Certainly. Well, currently there are about 1 billion people in the world who do not have access to safe, clean drinking water. And the UN estimates by 2025 that if the current situation is not addressed, two-thirds of the world population will not have access to safe, clean drinking water. And in fact, the most recent World Bank president estimated that the next world wars will be fought over water.
So you have some events coming up this week. Tell us about what's happening.
Certainly. Well, the World Water Forum is going on right now in Mexico City. It started last week, and it will go through March 22nd, which is World Water Day. And this Tuesday, we are holding a tap water challenge where we are inviting Portlanders to come out and take the challenge. And we're going to blindfold them and have them taste test tap water versus bottled water to really raise a lot of visibility around the issue of bottled water. And let folks know that, hey, what you think you're getting isn't necessarily the case, and that corporations, through the mass advertising, are really making water seem safer and cleaner than it actually is.
And how do people find out about what you're doing?
Sure. They can check out our website, which is stopcorporateabuse.org, and they also can come down to the challenge taking place tomorrow at 11 o'clock at the corner of Southwest Broadway and Southwest Montgomery down near PSU.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Mary. That's Mary Nicole of Corporate Accountability International.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
That's the KBOO Evening News for Monday, March 20th, 2006. If you have any questions or comments about what you heard this evening, please give us a buzz at 503-231-8032 and leave a message on extension 203 or send an email to pmnews@kboo.org. You're listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Corvallis at 100.7 FM on translator K264AA, and at Hood River at 91.9 on translator K220HR. You can log on to our website at kboo.fm. Our producer for tonight's newscast is Kirk Vanderveer. Our system producer is Steve Casburn. Tonight's audio editor is Noah Eaton. Special thanks to reporters Kate Welch and Rabia Yaman. Our engineer is John Delderfield. And the KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. And I'm Andy Seaton.
And I'm Marlies Franklin. Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio News, followed by Independent Native News. And coming up tomorrow at 7 o'clock, hear the KBOO Morning News. We'll be here bright and early, and thank you for joining us here on our newscast. This is KBOO, your nonprofit, community, volunteer-powered, and listener-sponsored radio station.
This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, March 20th, 2006. From KPFA in Berkeley, I'm Sandra Lupien, sitting in for Aura Fogado. On today's newscast, we'll hear from protesters around the country marking the three-year anniversary of the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq.
Because there's lives in the balance, because every day this war continues, U.S. soldiers are getting killed and wounded, and many, many more Iraqis are getting killed and wounded.
There's nothing to fear, but if nothing else, make sure you go and do something. Resist. Organize. Talk to the people around you. Do something.
Stop their teenage redneck act and get down to basics. Get ready to bring the boys home.
And as the World Water Forum continues in Mexico, Nigerians struggle for clean water that's been polluted by ExxonMobil. These stories and more, but first, these headlines.
From WBAI in New York, I'm Mitch Jezerich with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News.
Who's gonna set the wall?
This weekend, thousands of people across the globe took to the streets to mark the third-year anniversary of the invasion of Iraq and demonstrated against the continued U.S. presence there. Meanwhile, in Washington, a new report by the Congressional Research Office shows that the U.S. will spend 44% more on the war this year than last. Darby Hickey reports.
Spending on war and occupation will average almost $10 billion a month for this fiscal year, according to a new report by the nonpartisan Congressional Research Service. A substantial portion of that money will go to replace or repair military equipment and vehicles, the report says. Very little of these funds are for oversight of the billions spent on war, says Anita Danch of the National Priorities Project.
Congress could demand that there is much better mechanisms put into place to see where the money is going, where it's being spent. We have stories about money in Iraq being moved around in wheelbarrows. So Congress needs to put some institutional oversight in place that goes beyond what's being done so far.
Last week, the House of Representatives approved $72 billion for war costs. If passed by the Senate, that will bring the total to over $400 billion spent since 2001. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Darby Hickey in Washington, D.C.
Thousands of people took to the streets in the Eastern European country of Belarus after President Alexander Lukashenko was announced the winner in the presidential election. Results say Lukashenko received 82.6% of the vote. The European Union and the United States say they do not accept the outcome. Main opposition candidate Alexander Milinkovich called for street protests. Lukashenko said the vote was fair and denounced the foreign pressure. Russian President Vladimir Putin sent him his congratulations. After about a half a million people demonstrated in France over the weekend, a one-day general strike has been called to protest the government's youth employment plan. In Paris, Tony Cross reports.
Workers, students, and school students' unions meeting in Paris this evening have called a general strike for Tuesday, the 26th of March. It's the latest challenge to Prime Minister Dominique de Villepin's youth employment scheme, the CPE, a two-year contract for young workers which will mean that they can be fired without reason. Protests this weekend mobilized up to 1.5 million all over the country. Today the unions refused de Villepin's offer of dialogue, saying the CPE must be scrapped. Only minor students' groups turned up to a meeting with the Prime Minister this afternoon. Tomorrow, school students will stage a day of action, and there will be more protests Thursday, along with a strike by utilities workers against gas privatization. And unions seem confident that they can launch an even bigger protest next week if the government hasn't backed down by then. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Tony Cross in Paris.
In Palestine, a firefight broke out today between members loyal to the Fatah party demanding jobs and wages and Palestinian police forces in the Gaza Strip. Laila Haddad has a story from Gaza.
The gunmen, who belonged mainly to Fatah's Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigades, blocked off the main road leading to the Erez border crossing into Israel, exchanging fire with security forces in a two-hour-long gun battle. Later, they took the battle to the city, shooting at a police station in front of the foreign ministry and briefly storming a military hospital, wounding four people in the process. Machine gun fire echoed throughout Gaza, ricocheting off buildings and shops as police sirens whistled frantically up and down the streets. The gunmen were demanding unpaid wages and jobs, and though this is not the first time for them to do so, the latest episode comes at a critical time. The cash-strapped Palestinian Authority is increasingly finding it difficult to pay the salaries of the some 70,000 security forces it already employs, especially in the face of economic sanctions against it and worldwide isolation of the Hamas government. Much-needed foreign aid has been recalled by the United States, with other governments threatening to do the same. For Free Speech Radio News in Gaza, this is Leila Al-Haddad.
In Argentina, about 10,000 people participated in a massive protest this weekend in front of the home of former military dictator Jorge Rafael Videla, who is living under house arrest. This Friday is the anniversary of the beginning of his dictatorship, in which 30,000 people disappeared and thousands more detained and tortured. Google will have to hand over some of its records to the government. Eric Klein has the details.
The Department of Justice is getting just a tiny fraction of what it originally requested. Google can keep the terms entered into its search engine a secret, but a judge ordered it to hand over 50,000 URL or web addresses from its databases. Google lawyers are calling the ruling a clear victory, but warn that future subpoenas for the data it keeps are always a possibility. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Eric Klein.
And finally, the U.S. Supreme Court declined to hear an appeal brought by the tobacco company Philip Morris, in which it has to pay $50 million in punitive damages in a case of a longtime smoker who died of lung cancer. The Supreme Court also declined to hear an appeal by the state of New Jersey to reinstate the death penalty for Robert Marshall for killing his wife. An appeals court earlier ruled that his lawyer did not adequately represent him. And those are some of the headlines. I'm Mitch Jezrich for Free Speech Radio News.
Today marks the three-year anniversary of the start of the U.S.-led war on Iraq, and protesters have gathered around the world to oppose the U.S.-led occupation there. Washington, D.C. was the site of a solemn march to the Pentagon to illustrate the impact of the war to Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld. Meanwhile, lawmakers on Capitol Hill are indicating a deepening divide from the administration's description of the war. Leanne Caldwell reports.
Emotions and opinions are running high on this anniversary of the war in Iraq, while opinion polls show public support is at an all-time low. President Bush gave an address in Cleveland. He called conditions in Iraq tense, but focused on progress, and said that the U.S. would remain there.
So today I'd like to share a concrete example of progress in Iraq that most Americans do not see every day in their newspapers or on their television screens.
His example was about Tal Afar, a town in northern Iraq, where he says al-Qaeda was driven out. The president has a team of defenders spreading a positive message about continued U.S. military presence in Iraq. Vice President Dick Cheney appeared on CBS's Face the Nation, saying that Iraq is much better off than it was 3 years ago. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld wrote a column in Sunday's Washington Post that read, "Iraq has gained more than it's lost in the past 3 years, and that the U.S. cannot leave that country." And General George Casey on NBC's Meet the Press.
Yes, we're making good political progress, and yes, we continue to make good progress with the Iraqi security forces.
The administration continues to deny that Iraq is engaged in civil war. Again, General Casey.
And I do not believe, one, that we are in a civil war right now. Two, nor do I believe that a civil war is imminent or necessarily inevitable.
But former Iraqi Prime Minister Iyad Alawi told the BBC that if Iraq is not in the middle of a civil war, then he doesn't know what civil war is. And on Capitol Hill, lawmakers are acknowledging civil war and retreating further from the president on U.S. strategy. Democratic Senator Joe Biden from Delaware.
Republicans, the chairman of the Armed Services Committee, and they're all saying, "Mr. President, help, 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 help."
Moderate Democrat Representative John Murtha from Pennsylvania said he regrets his original support for the war and U.S. troops should withdraw immediately. Representative Murtha said on NBC's Meet the Press that the military is receiving poor leadership under Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld.
Well, he should offer his resignation.
Senator Biden said he too thinks that Rumsfeld should be fired and all of the president's top advisors on Iraq should be as well.
Imagine what the headline would be in every European paper, in every major paper around the world, if the headline read, "Bush fires Rumsfeld." Imagine what that would do for U.S. credibility.
U.S. Army Major General Paul Eaton wrote in a New York Times opinion piece yesterday that Donald Rumsfeld is incompetent and should resign. The White House has dismissed any talk of a turnover of staff. Senator Biden said the president needs to get involved and bring Iraqi players to the table.
Physically get on planes and travel to a destination and have it be made absolutely clear to them. The world is looking for a consensus. Absent that, they will be isolated by the world.
While lawmakers are talking to the press about Iraq, protesters continue to show their discontent. About 200 people marched from the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, D.C. to the Pentagon in a somber event. The only noise being a single bell, a single beat drum, and the cars driving by. The marchers followed a wooden coffin covered with pictures of Americans and Iraqis who have died in the war. They carried that coffin to the Pentagon to give it to what they call the Secretary of War, Donald Rumsfeld. Michelle Gressamese, a member of the National Campaign for Nonviolent Resistance.
I'm a mother, first of all. I have four children. And this war has seen so much devastation of lives beyond what I could even really imagine, and senseless loss of lives. And I think we really need to make our voices heard, and we need to make this administration do what's right. It's immoral what's happened.
Several of the marchers were arrested when they tried to get through the gates of the Pentagon property. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
As demonstrators and lawmakers weighed in on the effects of war in the nation's capital, 150 veterans and their supporters marched into New Orleans on Sunday to make the economic connection between military efforts in Iraq and the failure to rebuild the Gulf Coast. The rally marked the conclusion of a five-day march from Mobile, Alabama, to New Orleans, through some of the areas most devastated by Hurricane Katrina. FSRN's Christian Roseland has more.
U.S. military veterans from three generations and five wars marched together with supporters into New Orleans on Sunday to draw attention to the region's plight. Jeffrey Millard is a sergeant with the U.S. Army who spent 13 months in Iraq. In a rally in New Orleans' Congo Square at the end of the march, Millard said that he wished he could have been to the region sooner, but that his government had kept him in another country. Millard, like many, compared the meager federal funding of Gulf Coast rebuilding to the rebuilding of other areas.
As we walked through all these devastated places, it looked like a lot of the places that I've seen. And I looked at Manhattan, I look at Manhattan today and how well it's been rebuilt and how quickly we mobilize an effort for humanitarian aid. And I look at Iraq and how we're going to spend $510 billion this year brutalizing that country. Is there a rep from SOS here? What could you do with $510 billion?
Also at the rally, Common Ground founder and Vietnam veteran Malik Rahim thanked one of the chief organizers of the march, Veterans for Peace, for generous early support, saying that without the veterans there would be no Common Ground. Rahim's aid organization has been providing medical care, distributing supplies, and gutting homes since the first days after the storm. President Bush's recent request to Congress for $4.6 billion to rebuild the Gulf Coast has passed the House, but is bundled with a much larger sum for expenditures in Iraq. Local leaders are quick to point out that they do not know how much of this money will make its way to Louisiana, or how much individual homeowners will receive. For FSRN, this is Christian Roseland.
Demonstrators in Connecticut held two large anti-war demonstrations in their state to mark the anniversary of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. FSRN's Melinda Tuhus was at both events and files this report.
On Saturday, protesters walked to the New Haven Green through the city's largest Latino neighborhood. The diverse crowd called for justice for the Palestinian people and support for the rights of immigrants, along with the key demand of pulling U.S. troops out of Iraq immediately. At the Green, longtime peace activist and state representative Bill Dyson said it's important for those who oppose the war to take action, despite attacks on their civil liberties.
There's nothing to fear, but if nothing else, make sure you go and do something. Resist. Organize. Talk to the people around you. Do something. Do something. Do something. Thank you.
On Sunday, a slightly larger but less diverse crowd rallied in Hartford. Speakers from religious, peace, and labor groups addressed the crowd, including Jessica White, a Connecticut member of Military Family Speak Out. She said her husband, Jay, is currently serving his second deployment in Iraq. White said it's time to heal the wounds of war for both Iraqis and Americans.
However, this cannot be done until every last soldier is back at home, here with us, and the U.S. government fully withdraws all military personnel from Iraq, replacing our loved ones with U.N. peacekeeping forces.
After the rally, the protesters marched to the office of Senator Joe Lieberman, a strong supporter of the war, with coffins representing the costs of the war in dollars, lives lost, and damage to American values. For FSRN, I'm Melinda Tuhus in Hartford.
Members of South Dakota Peace and Justice met at the Rapid City office of Congresswoman Stephanie Herseth last Friday to call for the impeachment of President Bush and Vice President Cheney in connection to the ongoing war in Iraq. FSRN's Jim Kent spoke to activists to examine their views on the Bush administration, the war in Iraq, and its impact on people living in the U.S.
If pre-war intelligence was manipulated...
Members of South Dakota Peace and Justice support U.S. House Resolution 635, introduced by Michigan Representative John Conyers, the House Judiciary Committee's ranking Democrat. The legislation calls for a select committee to investigate charges of criminal acts by the President and Vice President, alleging the Bush administration manipulated pre-war intelligence in order to gain popular and congressional support for invading Iraq. South Dakota Peace and Justice spokesperson Rosalie Little Thunder agrees with that view.
We've been lied to before about why we attacked Iraq, and we're being told a lot of things about why we should take a look at Iran now. It's very disturbing that we would continue to be, you know, a tyrant country.
Marv Kammerer brought a body bag to Representative Herseth's office to remind her that each of the 2,300 Americans who died in Iraq had someone waiting for them at home.
Stick them in a box, fly them home under the cover of darkness so nobody sees. Stick them in the ground, forget about them. Cut the budget. You know, my kids, grandkids are going to have to pay for this goddamn mess.
Kammerer adds that it's time for the Bush administration to grow up.
Stop their teenage redneck act and get down to basics. Get ready to bring the boys home.
Rosalie Little Thunder pointed out that the demonstration's primary goal was to advise Representative Herseth she was elected to serve the people of South Dakota.
You know, the leadership should be listening to the people that voted for them and not just going along with what's happening in Washington.
I would if I could bring them back home.
Further clarification of that point may be needed. The Congresswoman's office released a statement Friday afternoon noting that Herseth does not believe supporting Kanye's call to investigate the Bush administration is the proper action at this time. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Jim Kent in Rapid City, South Dakota.
Washington residents began their protest against the war on Friday with a modest but persistent vigil bolstered by other recent actions. FSRN's Matthew Bradley reports from D.C., where the days leading up to the anniversary of the invasion on Iraq brought new and veteran activists together to call for an end to the occupation.
Good afternoon, and welcome to our Lenten Witness for Peace and Justice. On this St. Patrick's Day, we're reminded of the quote from St. Patrick, "Killing is not with Christ."
Art Laffin of the Dorothy Day Catholic Worker opens a weekly lunch hour vigil on Pennsylvania Avenue. Laffin is facing the White House, and 20 fellow activists stand opposite him, facing passersby. Undiscouraged by March weather, they are marking the third anniversary of the 2003 invasion of Iraq. Some have been participating in this observance since it started in 1998. They reject not just the Iraq War, but the sanctions that preceded it, the current war in Afghanistan, and war-making in general. Cynthia Bannis is a Vernon, New York native who traveled to Iraq during the sanctions and is protesting not just the Iraq War, but possible U.S. actions against Iran.
How could I not come to the Capitol? This is where these policies are made, and there's no response or little response from our local Representative Bollard or our senators, Senator Clinton and Senator Schumer. Senator Clinton especially wants more troops over there.
Mike Ferner identifies himself as a former U.S. Navy hospital corpsman from Ohio. He is part of a delegation from a separate month-long daily fast and vigil outside the U.S. Capitol building. And the reason he is here is plain to him as well.
Because there's lives in the balance. Because every day this war continues, U.S. soldiers are getting killed and wounded, and many, many more Iraqis are getting killed and wounded. And we just have to find out what is the best thing we can be doing and throw ourselves into it.
The activists stood for an hour, reading aloud statements of conscience as tourists passed, most of them outwardly indifferent, or more compelled by the cold to move on than to pause for very long. As the vigil dispersed, Art Laffin offered his explanation for why he and his peers persevere.
Every act of conscience that people take to stand for life, to stand for love, in resistance to killing and war is a very valuable thing.
FSRN's Matt Bradley in Washington. One of the objectives of the ongoing Fourth World Water Forum in Mexico City is to find a sustainable solution to the obstacles facing the precious liquid. And some point out that some of those obstacles are created by multinational companies. In Nigeria's Niger Delta region, many people are dying of waterborne diseases because Western oil companies are polluting clean water in the area. Some of the worst affected communities are those near the main operating area of U.S.-based ExxonMobil. Sam Olokoya reports from the Niger Delta.
The people of the little village of Itak Abasi say they are facing a health emergency. Many in the village are ill from waterborne diseases. Festus Friday, a university student, says death from waterborne diseases is on the rise.
The death rate has increased to a level that we can't tell. So that's just what is happening here.
Villagers queue for drugs during one of the outbreaks of waterborne diseases. Senior health worker Miriam Antiga is hardly surprised that the people are dying of waterborne diseases.
I had to mobilize my health team because of I heard that so many people were died because of the outbreak. You go there, you see the water that they are drinking is just like royalty.
Itak Abasi is located in a swamp surrounded by dirty, stagnant water. Most of the people drink the dirty water. Ordinarily, rainwater would have been a cleaner alternative. But gas flaring by ExxonMobil is causing problems. Local youth Samuel Chebe says it is unsafe to drink rainwater because it is normally contaminated by the deadly gases from about 10 ExxonMobil gas flares around the village.
And when rain fall and fall, therefore the polluted this gas will now mix with the rain water. Then it falls. And when we put a container to collect the water, you will see from the water that the water is polluted. Whenever we take it, it will affect us. That also causes so many types of diseases.
Scores of other villages in the area are suffering from waterborne diseases because of pollution from ExxonMobil's gas flares. The oil company recently announced an unprecedented net income of over $36 billion for 2005. About a fifth of the company's oil exploitation is done in the Niger Delta. Local communities in the region say ExxonMobil is making profit at their expense. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Sam Olukoya in the Niger Delta.
Environmentalists see President Bush's nomination of Idaho Governor Dirk Kempthorne to head the Department of the Interior as an extension of Secretary Gail Norton's blueprint. They cite that under Norton's policy, extractive industries are able to get everything they seek from federal lands. FSRN's Lee Robartis takes a look at the record of the man who will likely be confirmed to run the Interior Department.
President Bush is portraying his Interior Secretary nominee Dirk Kempthorne as a consensus builder and a nature lover.
When he and his wife Patricia were married, they chose to hold a ceremony atop Idaho's Moscow Mountain at sunrise. Dirk said, "I don't think there's a more beautiful cathedral than the outdoors."
The 54-year-old Kempthorne only spent one term as a U.S. senator, but he was immediately effective, introducing the popular Senate Bill 1 in 1995, which prohibited unfunded federal mandates. As governor, he led negotiations settling one of the West's largest water rights agreements, exchanging the Nez Perce Tribe Snake River claims for cash and land from the federal and state governments.
Mr. President, one of the hallmarks of my public service has been my ability to bring people to the table and to work together to build consensus. I pledge to you and to the American people that I will continue in that role of reaching out and finding solutions.
If confirmed as Interior Secretary, which oversees enforcement of the Endangered Species Act, Kempthorne is in a position to reverse some of the very federal policies he fought as governor. Idaho Fish and Game is currently seeking permission from the department to kill 43 wolves in one pack to help elk hunting, saying the wolves are an experimental, non-essential population under the act.
What the secretary can do is very limited.
Professor Jay O'Laughlin is a resource policy specialist at the University of Idaho and has worked with Kemp Thorne as a member of the Western Governors Association Forest Advisory Committee.
The agency is peopled with professionals who are there for their career. The actual policies are made out there on the ground where the federal agents go to do their work.
Gary McFarlane of the Idaho-based Forest Watch group Friends of the Clearwater says the Interior Secretary can stall species listings under the Endangered Species Act.
The wolverine, for example, is one here in our region that is very endangered and should be listed. The West Slope cutthroat trout is another one that needs to be looked at seriously.
O'Laughlin contends what's important is what's done to recover species once listed, and he says most of the major ones are listed. Jonathan Oppenheimer with the Idaho Conservation League has other issues with Kemp Thorne.
One of the first things that we'll be looking for from Kemp Thorne is his position on the issue of the selling off of public land.
As the Republican-dominated legislature overwhelmingly passed a moratorium against the administration's proposed sell-off of 300,000 acres of Forest Service land nationwide, Governor Kemp Thorne did not take a stand when asked. Under Kemp Thorne, Idaho sued to stop the Clinton-era roadless rule from taking effect. The rule would have prohibited most timber harvesting and mining in 58.5 million roadless Forest Service acres in 39 states. When the Bush administration threw out the rule rather than defend it in court, it replaced it by giving governors the opportunity to decide how the areas would be managed. Some Western governors decided to manage as wilderness, but Kemp Thorne jumped at the opportunity, handing county commissioners the task of making management recommendations.
Dirk understands that those who live closest to the land know how to manage it best.
For Matthew Kaler of the Montana-based Native Forest Network, that's code for rural leaders making decisions favoring extractive industry interests. Kaler says Kemp Thorne is pro-logging, pro-motorized recreation, and pro-user fees for public lands, but he has an engaging personality and can talk a good talk.
But when he walks the walk, it is really at the bequest of the resource extraction industry and those who would like to see our public lands privatized.
To Tim Hermack of Oregon's Native Forest Council, Kemp Thorne has always been a political lackey of industry.
It's as if their policy was rip it up, tear it out, and let our children do without, and to hell with the consequences. Even the extinction of the human race doesn't matter.
Kemp Thorne's confirmation vote is expected to come up in the Senate in about 3 weeks. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Lee Robartis in Moscow, Idaho.
Free Speech Radio News is a worker-run collective. Our newscast is produced at Pacifica Stations WBAI in New York, KPFA in Berkeley, and KPFK in Los Angeles. FSRN is produced by Simba Russo and Monica Lopez. This week's headlines editor is Mitch Jezerich, sitting in for Shannon Young. Our Washington editor is Leanne Caldwell. Our technical production team includes Jade Padgett-Seekins, Eric Klein, and Antonio Ortiz. You can get a copy of this or any other FSRN newscast or documentary at our website, www.fsrn.org. From KPFA in Berkeley, I'm Sandra Lupien, sitting in for Aura Fogado.
This is Independent Native News for Monday, the 20th of March. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock. Native American tribes, along with states in the Western Great Lakes region, are preparing to take over management of the gray wolf population. That is, if a federal plan to stop listing the wolf as an endangered or threatened species in three Midwest states becomes law. Chuck Kornbach of Wisconsin Public Radio reports.
The Interior Department says the gray wolf population in Minnesota, Michigan, and Wisconsin combined is roughly 4,000 and growing. The department says that's large enough to remove most of the protections for the wolf under the Federal Endangered Species Act and let the three states and the Native American tribes within them take over management of the wolf. The Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewa says somewhere between 4 and 10 wolves live within the boundaries of the tribe's reservation in northern Wisconsin. The tribe's wildlife specialist, Tom Doolittle, says he's been working with state and federal officials on what to do with wolves that attack livestock just off the tribe's property. He says giving permits to farmers so they could shoot problem wolves would only be a last resort.
Well, most importantly, when you look at the cultural significance of wolves to the Anishinaabe, therefore, when I look at the wolf as a manager, I don't necessarily see a fur bearer. But what I do see is a cultural center of a tribe.
Doolittle says there are non-lethal ways to control problem wolves beyond capturing and releasing them elsewhere. Some technology being tested would involve fitting livestock and a problem wolf with electronic collars that produce a jolt to the wolf when it gets too close to the farm animal. But all that has to wait until the federal wolf delisting plan would take effect. Public hearings on the proposal will be held this spring. I'm Chuck Quernbach.
Canada's National Chief of the Assembly of First Nations says the Conservative cabinet will likely approve the residential school agreement in principle. Phil Fontaine says he was concerned about election campaign statements by the Conservative Party that they would attempt to change the deal. At stake is almost $2 billion in payments to 80,000 Aboriginal people who suffered abuse at the federally run schools. The CBC's Josie Bellemare reports.
Phil Fontaine says he's met with the Indian and Northern Affairs Minister three times since the new Conservative government was elected in January. Fontaine says Jim Prentice has not given him any reason to believe that the residential school agreement will be changed in any way.
We believe that it will be implemented. We haven't heard anything to the contrary. And so we're anxious to get on with the early payment to the elderly and cabinet approval of the compensation package.
Fontaine was concerned during the federal election that a new Conservative government would alter the agreement. During the election campaign, Stephen Harper said he would follow through with the agreement with minor changes. If that happened, Fontaine says the delicate and complex agreement would fall apart. Sarah Manchani speaks for the Federal Department of Indian Residential Schools resolution.
The Government of Canada is committed to achieving a fair and lasting resolution of the legacy of Indian residential schools, and the Minister is looking forward to the completion of these discussions.
Manchani says the parties are back at the table negotiating the final agreement now. Heritage Minister Bev Oda, who's responsible for this file, did not want to comment on the issue. Jose Belmar, Ottawa.
A claim of Mohegan artifacts at a marina construction site in Norwich, Connecticut, has failed to pan out. WSHU's Ebong Udama reports.
Connecticut State archaeologist Nick Bellantoni says the objects found at the site are not from ancient Native American burials, but from Norwich's recent industrial past.
Turns out that those artifacts were misinterpreted. Rather than being stone slates of Native American manufacture, they turned out to be slates from roofs of fragments from roofs roofing during the historic period.
Workers at the Norwich Marina construction site thought they had found remnants of tools, arrowheads, and other Indian artifacts. Bellantoni, who was accompanied on a visit to the site by Mohegan tribal officials, says people should continue to report such findings to the appropriate state authorities. In Fairfield, Connecticut, I'm Ebong Udama.
This is Independent Native News. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock.
Supported by News from Indian Country's e-edition, online at IndianCountryNews.com. Independent Native News is a production of KUAC at the University of...
Hi, Ralph Keyes here. In March of 1971, a new sound went out over the radio in Portland. The station was KABU, and the sound was bluegrass music. Now we're inviting you to a party to help celebrate the 35th anniversary of Music from the True Vine, the longest-running bluegrass show on the West Coast. It's happening on Sunday, April 2nd, starting at 2 p.m. We're having music all day, a chili and cornbread feed, and we'll round out the evening with a swing dance. The KABU Bluegrass DJs will share MC duties, so if you ever wanted to put a face to those familiar voices, this is your chance. Bands performing will include Jack Straw, Lee Highway, Greg Clark, Kid Mello and the Sleepy Eyed Johns, Little Joe, and the Flat Mountain Girls. A Northwest Fiddle Summit will feature some of the area's greatest fiddlers, and Portland's favorite Western band, The Buckles, will provide music for the evening swing dance. So come on out, 2 p.m. on Sunday, April 2nd at the Wonder Ballroom, 128 North Russell in Portland, for music, chili, dancing, and general celebration. I'll see you there.
Tickets are available at Pioneer Music, Artichoke Music, Wally's Music in Oregon City, at the KABU office, the Wonder Ballroom box office, and all Ticketmaster outlets.